This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We call our show Main Street because we spend some time on this Main Street during our day, just like you do in the Main Streets in your towns, whether it's called Main Street or Broadway or First Avenue or University or, well, State Street. Whatever it's called, it's where we are right now. And joining us at our microphone, Peter Vogt. And I've got Ashley Thornburg here as well. We're going to talk to Peter Vogt about his book, The Introvert Manifesto, Introverts Illuminated, Extroverts Enlightened. And I ask myself this question virtually every day, Peter. It's curious that you bring it up, but am I an introvert or am I an extrovert? I don't know.
I don't know either, Doug. I think you sort of ballpark it like most of us do. There are some ways that you can find out. You can take the Myers-Briggs type indicator and get an idea, but most people just have a general sense of it as they grow up and as they move on through their years, well, depending on what they do and depending on what they like to do.
Yeah, I was intrigued by the book that you really consider it to be a spectrum, and that really you kind of make the argument that no one is just an introvert and no one is just an extrovert.
No, that's exactly right. There's no, I write in the book, there's no such thing as an introvert. It's just shorthand. And, you know, even in the book title, the Introvert Manifesto comes off the tongue a lot better than the manifesto of the introvert or the guy who prefers introversion most of the time.
But the word manifesto does jump out because obviously you feel pretty strongly about this and you identify as an introvert.
I absolutely do. And I do feel strongly about it. And I went around and around with that word manifesto because it is kind of a loaded word, if you will. But basically, to me, it just means you feel very strongly about something and you have something to say. And that's why I ultimately went with that word.
Well, introvert itself is kind of a loaded word. And I think especially the synonyms that come to mind when you first hear that word introvert.
Like, synonym. There are a lot of synonyms. Now, granted, I'll do some cherry picking here, but the typical synonyms for introvert are shy, aloof, cold, standoffish, that sort of thing. Whereas the extroverts, they seem to get the good ones. They get gregarious, they get social, they get outgoing. And so,
so a not too subtle indication that we should aspire to be extroverts if you're looking at the environment we're in, the culture we're in.
In our culture, that's how it seems to be. That's the message that many introverts get. Now, you can debate whether that's accurate or not. That's another matter. But that's the message that I always got growing up, especially, is that, and I'm not alone in this fact, a lot of introverts end up thinking something must be wrong with me. Something must be wrong with me because a lot of the things that it seems like I'm supposed to enjoy, I just don't.
There's a real sense that introverts are the ones who have to defend themselves and not the other way around.
That's what I would say, Ashley. I mean, you can say other extroverts might say something differently, but that's how it seems to be for me. I wrote a thing in the book, a little parody almost, where it talked about there was an introvert and an extrovert talking about after what they're going to do after work. And typically, an extrovert might invite me out for something after work, and I say, I'm kind of tired. I just want to go home. And that's when the badgering will often come on, and they'll say, come on, you're going to miss all the fun.
You're antisocial.
You're going to miss all the fun. So I turned that around, and I said, you know, what if the introvert were to say to the extrovert, man, you're going to miss all the solitude. If you go to a party, you're going to miss all the solitude. Why don't you come and do some solitude with me? I just don't do that as an introvert. No introvert does.
Well, we know that one synonym for introvert is not shyness. So let's talk about how Peter Vogt identifies as an introvert. How are your personality traits reflect this introversion?
Well, I like my alone time like most introverts do. That doesn't mean I always want to be alone. But basically what it means is that I need my alone time each day to think and to process and to have some time to just recharge. You mentioned shyness, Doug. I think that if you were to talk to the man or the woman on the street and say, what is an introvert, they probably would say a shy person. A shy person is really something different. It's very related. Introverts can be shy. Extroverts can be shy too. Shyness introduces a fear element into this whole mix. When I was in junior high school and I was in love with a girl from afar and I couldn't go up to her to talk to her, I wasn't standing back saying, you know what, I just don't have the energy for this as an introvert. What I was really saying is I'm terrified of talking to this girl and looking like an idiot and feeling stupid. That's shyness. That's social anxiety, and that's something we can all work on if we have that. Whereas introversion is just a part of who I am. I like my alone time. I like to have time to think. I like to focus on one or two things at a time instead of 10. And I love to get into things in a lot of depth versus I would rather know 3 things in a lot of depth than 10 things in a lot of breadth. That's what sort of defines me and as an introvert, and that's what defines introverts in general.
Do you think, though, that, I mean, especially in a hugely global society and just a large society at that, that introverts do need to learn a little bit? I know you've used the phrase coming out of their shell and you don't like that phrase. But for want of a better term, just to integrate in society better?
Of course you have to. I mean, there's no denying that. You have to learn your social skills. You have to learn your communication skills. You have to learn to get along with others on a team, let's say at work or whatever it might be. But if you know about yourself that you also need this other part of life, it's basically all you're looking for is a balance. Nobody, I'm sure, not saying that, you know, you don't ever have to do anything extroverted in life, so to speak, because you do. We all have to, and it's a good thing. I would never argue for a 100% introvert sort of life. but we do. That being said, I want to make sure that I, as an introvert and all introverts, also just respect and acknowledge that introverted part of yourself and take care of it so that you're happy and healthy.
The full title of your book is The Introvert Manifesto, Introverts Illuminated, Extroverts Enlightened. So we're illuminating a bit the introvert piece here. We're shedding some light on a behavior, a personality trait, or set of traits. Well, let's do a little enlightenment here for extroverts, because obviously you've got an issue with extroverts who don't understand you.
To some degree, I do. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Doug. I mean, sometimes extroverts in my life have badgered me to do things that I don't want to do, or seemingly so. And it seems like extroverts, to some degree, not all extroverts, I would never go that far, but to some degree, they do want you to be the way that they are. Whereas I, as an introvert, tend not to demand that of extroverts in return. I realize I'm making a huge blanket statement when I say such a thing, but that's just been my experience. And we talked a little bit earlier about the cultural ideal of how we should strive to become more extroverted, and that's how it often feels to introverts.
You've got to do something that other people don't have to do.
Exactly. And it's just, the teeter-totter of life seems to be favored in the extrovert direction in our culture. I don't think it should be flip-flopped into the introvert's direction. I just wish it would be a little bit more balanced. And I wish that for the sake of introverts and extroverts both.
We have a question from Laura in Fargo on Facebook, and she asks, what do you find to be the most misunderstood thing about introverts?
The most misunderstood thing that I, in my experience, is this whole need for alone time, the whole need for solitude. Let's say you've got you have an extrovert and an introvert and a couple and a married couple, and they both come home from work on a Friday. And they're exhausted. The extrovert might very well want to go out to a party that night. The introvert might very well want to do the exact opposite, sit and read a book. And it leads to a lot of conflict. And the introvert in that situation, who I can more readily relate to, is simply just wanting to recharge their batteries. And it can be seen as being, like you said earlier, Doug, antisocial. You're being antisocial. You don't want to be with other people. And that's not really the case at all. It's just a way of recharging my batteries so that I can be with people. And I do like being with people and socializing just as much as extroverts do. But I get to a point where I need to stop and recharge my batteries. And that tends to be the most misunderstood element of being an introvert, is that need to be able to do that.
In your book, that was actually the element that really caught me most by surprise. And that is that the introvert and when stimulated, may actually run out of energy. You get tired.
Exactly. And it is a physical thing as well as a mental thing. You're just drained at the end of a day. And the way that I recharge as an introvert is just not the same as the way an extrovert might recharge. And it's not to say that one is worse than the other or one is bad and one is good. It's just different. And that's actually what I wish, and Laura, I think was her name, I wish that's what people would better understand.
Yeah, there's this real balance of energy that one finds that taxing, and then the other, that recharges the battery. They feed off that energy.
Yep.
I think you brought up another interesting thing when you said the alone time, because to me, well, and to everyone really, there is a remarkable difference between being alone and being lonely. So what do those mean to you?
Lonely is something nobody ever wants to be, in my experience. I often want to be alone to recharge my batteries or to read or whatever it might be. But lonely, there's a sadness element. Lonely, there's a longing to be with somebody, and you can't for whatever reason. Whereas alone time, solitude, is a choice that I make to recharge my batteries. And even it's funny that you bring that up, because sometimes I would like to be alone, literally all alone. Sometimes I want to be alone at the coffee shop with a few other people around.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody has those moments.
Yes, absolutely. So even that is a little bit different. But lonely, the difference for me, I guess, is between lonely and alone time is that when you're lonely, you really desperately want to be with somebody for whatever reason, and you just can't be. The circumstances aren't allowing it, and that makes you sad and miserable, which makes sense.
Well, in your manifesto, you point out the four pillars of introvert well-being. So lay those out for us.
Well, that came from, I sat down one day and said, you know, most people are not into this topic as much as I am, this whole idea. That you're interested, you guys are interested, and I thank you for that, but I wish I could sum up what I have to say in just like on a poster or something in one fell swoop. I got to thinking about, well, when do I feel my absolute worst as an introvert? When I feel my worst, I'm not getting any alone time at all. I don't have any time to think before I react or do anything. I am being pulled in way too many directions at one time. I don't have much focus at all. And I don't get to get into anything in any kind of depth. I'm scratching at the surface of everything. So that's where I got this idea that how could I come up with a model that I could use myself to keep myself happy and healthy every day? And this is where the four pillars of introvert well-being came from. The first, and basically all it is it's something you can use as an introvert each day to check yourself and see if you're taking care of yourself in these four areas. The first one is solitude. Am I getting alone time? Am I getting some quiet time to myself every day? The second one is reflection. Am I getting some time to think? Am I getting some time to think before I have to say something? Am I getting some time to think after I've said something in case I want to rephrase it or revisit it? The third pillar is focus. Am I able to focus on one thing at a time, one person at a time, instead of 10? And depth is the final one. Am I able to get into some depth when I'm talking to somebody like I'm talking to the two of you now, for example? Or am I able to get into some depth in a relationship with somebody or on a book that I'm reading? If you talk to an introvert and you say, what's the perfect vacation activity? A lot of them will say, you know what, I'd love to just read a good book by the beach. And I think the reason that that matters to them is because it takes care of these four pillars. You've got your solitude, you've got your thinking, you've got your focus, and you've got your depth. You're lost in a good book. It couldn't be better.
How important is it for people to understand their place on the spectrum of introversion and extroversion?
Well, I mean, it's important for two different sets of people, introverts being the first set of people, because like I said, we've talked a bit about this. A lot of introverts tend to think that something's wrong with them because of the way that they've grown up or whatever it might be. And it's important to just understand that where introversion is concerned, it's just part of who you are. Even if you're pretty well adjusted as an introvert, as many are, then it comes to the idea of taking care of yourself and using those four pillars, in my case, to take care of yourself to stay happy and healthy. Extroverts, on the other hand, if they can understand introverts a little bit better in their lives, and trust me, this cuts both ways. Introverts need to understand extroverts too, but I'll let somebody else write the extrovert manifesto. Extroverts understanding introverts does wonders for relationships of all kinds, marriages, parent-child teacher, student, whatever it might be.
Teacher, student, there it is, because, you know, this takes a remarkable amount of self-actualization and thought to realize, to even know to realize that your personality and someone else's personality might not mesh. And Amy in Moorhead wants to know, do you think that educators are taught to respect different learning styles of the introverts versus the extroverts?
Well, I think it depends on the educator. I think a lot actually are quite familiar with it. My fiance is an educator, and she's very familiar with it. She, in some ways, has to be, so she's hanging around me, but she's also an introvert. I think more and more that educators are really on top of that. Now, whether they're executing that in the classroom is another matter, because sometimes sometimes a student who's not talking enough in class or raising their hand enough in class might be pegged as they're not really participating, when they just might simply be an introvert and they're participating very well, but they're just not raising their hand to respond, maybe instantly or at all, or they might go up after class or whatever.
Well, Peter's book is titled The Introvert Manifesto, Introverts Illuminated, Extroverts Enlightened. And if you'd like to learn more about what he's talking about and what the book's about, there'll be an opportunity to get a free preview at Dunn Brothers at 25th Street and 13th Avenue South in Fargo next Thursday. It runs an hour from 7 to 8 o'clock, and you'll be talking about your book.
I will be talking about the book and talking about what makes introverts tick and why.
Well, thank you very much, Peter Vogt, for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, Kim Crowley.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with Angels Sing, Liberia in America. Then at 8:30 Central, The Best of Daniel O'Donnell. And at 10, Victor Borga. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and that Latin jazz in the background is Stephen Croon, In My Path is the name of the CD. Kim Crowley teaches English at Bismarck State College, and she writes an essay for us that we'd like to share with you. And today, she's talking about them and us.
I teach writing to first and second year college students. When people meet me and hear what I do for a living, most of the time their first reaction is something akin to, "Oh, their writing is terrible, isn't it?" Or they simply offer a conciliatory pat on the shoulder. There is an understanding that my job is hard because the quality of the students isn't what it used to be. This might be true in some ways, but I think it's wrong to take a them and us approach. After all, us have been them at some point, haven't we? One of my first semesters as a teaching assistant at NDSU, a professor gave us an article written by another college professor complaining about the deplorable state of student writing and study habits. We talked about it, readying ourselves for what we were about to face as we marched into the classroom, figuring this was something recently published in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Turns out it was written in the 1890s. At that early point in my teaching career, one idea was cemented. There has really never been a time when our society said young adults are getting it right. Most of my students were born around 1995 or 1996, well after I was done with my first round of college. They've had computers in their schools and cellular phones in their homes and Fox animated series on their television for as long as they can remember. They only know Schoolhouse Rock because their parents made them watch it, and they are used to lots and lots of standardized tests. Sometimes I shake my head at what they wear to class, but one trip down Polaroid memory lane shows me my fashion choices when I was their age leave me no room for criticism. Tech plays a big role in how we see young adults as well. Almost all of my students have smartphones, which can present a big problem because so many of them are checking or sending messages during class. I tell them to put the phones away, and they do, and we move on. I can walk back to my office fuming about this stupid millennial addiction to texting and Facebook or Snapchat or whatever it is they're always checking. And then I go to a meeting populated with colleagues and realize that many of them are also checking messages during the meeting. Granted, my colleagues are most likely answering emails for work, but the effect is the same. Heads down, surreptitious tapping, incomplete attention. At the risk of making it sound as if I am some sort of Disney princess professor with cartoon birds perched on my shoulder, let me clarify. I know that I will go through the pile of papers on my desk, and at some point, rest my forehead on my hand in despair, and take a few minutes to go online and look for an opportunity to pursue my alternate dream career as a park ranger. But then I will pick up the next paper and there will be something in it that's smart or interesting, and I'll move on. Do I get nervous at the prospect of my students making decisions that will affect me in my retirement and in old age when I'm most vulnerable? Sure. But it's folly to think that my generation, or even my parents' generation, struck any less fear into the hearts of their elders. We were going to hell in a handbasket when women started going to college, when Elvis gyrated, when students protested war. Like it or not, every generation gets accused of being the scourge of the future. Each generation vilifies the next in some way, largely because this new crop of young people isn't doing it the way we did it. Students in their late teens and early 20s are the offspring of my peers. We must keep in mind that if we don't like what we see, we might want to glance in a mirror. All I can say is this. Don't count them out. They might just surprise us all and pull off this whole running the world thing.
That's Kim Crowley, and let's hope so. Them and us. Well, it's time to think about a we. We'll have Chuck Lura in just a moment.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro, and when I'm not reporting from around the world, I sometimes sing with a band called Pink Martini. And if you think your old car has seen better days, try riding around in the back of a band van after 3 weeks on tour. When the time comes to upgrade your ride, donate it to this station. You'll get a tax break, and we'll tow it away for free. Turn your car into the programs you love. Here's how.
Find out how you can donate your unwanted vehicle at prairiepublic.org or call 1-800-359-6900.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and he prepares an essay for us we call Natural North Dakota, because he takes us into the woods or into the prairie and the streams and the lakes and all those places where Natural North Dakota exists and points out those things we really ought to pay attention to. Today, it's the diamond willow.
Most people are familiar with diamond willow. Some nice walking sticks, picture frames, and other items can be made from this colorful wood. But there seems to be some confusion as to what it is. Occasionally, someone will ask me if diamond willow is a species or whether it comes from a diseased tree. We presently recognize about 16 species of willow in North Dakota. One species, Salix areocephala, formerly Salix missouriensis, is commonly referred to as Missouri willow or diamond willow. So end of story? Not so fast. Actually, what most people call diamond willow is very likely one of a half dozen willow species with a fungal infection of Valsa sordida, or perhaps a close relative. The fungus is a type of sac fungus that attacks some members of the willow family, which in addition to willows includes cottonwood and aspen or poplar. The fungus has not been well studied, though. The most cited reference to the cause of this interesting growth in willows goes back to an academic journal article from 1958. The disease often attacks the willow where the branch attaches to the main stem. Cankers then form, which have a rather elongated ovals and pointed ends, or diamonds. Although the bark is gray, the underlying sapwood is generally a creamy white with a light reddish-brown heartwood. Oftentimes, a particular willow will be badly infested, while other plants in the area may be quite healthy. I noticed there are several internet sites that sell diamond bark items ranging from walking sticks to beds. It's also available on eBay. Prices for walking sticks can range from $65 upward, depending on how fancy they are. Winter can be a good time to look for diamond willow. When I check for diamond willow, I usually cut a small piece of bark around one of the diamonds to check for color and go from there. So if you're interested in making your own diamond willow walking stick, or perhaps even some furniture, now might be a good time to get out and check out the local supply. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, the connection between gas taxes and the highways we drive on. Chef Rosie will drop by to talk about soda bread. That's an Irish favorite with a lot of American tradition to it as well. Ashley Thornburg and I will look at what's happening, and of course we'll have Dakota Date Book. But now, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Democratic legislators want the Senate Appropriations Committee to restore some of the things the House took out of the higher education budget. Senate Minority Leader Max Schneider says one piece is a two-year tuition freeze at the community colleges and a 2.5% per year cap on tuition at the four-year schools.
We've seen too often in the past where we leave town at the end of the session without a tuition cap in place, and tuition increases beyond what we thought it was going to when we were funding higher education.
A second piece would be to return to the funding formula the legislature passed in 2013. The House committee changed the formula. State Representative Alyssa Mitzgog of Wahpeton says schools like North Dakota State College of Science are taking more than their fair share of reductions.
The cuts were not fair and they were inequitable.
The Democrats also want the auditors and attorneys to stay with the university system. The House action moved the auditors to the state auditor's office and the attorneys to the attorney general's office. And they say the House authorized 3% per year pay raises for higher education employees, but didn't fund them. A House committee will be considering a bill that originally required oil companies to pay royalties to landowners for flared natural gas. Instead, the Senate changed the bill so that the legislature's budget section would receive reports on the fiscal impact to the state of actions by the State Industrial Commission to curb flaring.
Instead of doing things that would help reduce our excessive flaring that's done in North Dakota, the Senate actually went backwards.
Don Morrison is the executive director of the Dakota Resource Council. He says DRC members aren't the only ones who feel that way. Morrison says a study was done by UND.
65% of North Dakotans support requiring royalty payments to mineral owners when the gas is wasted through flaring. 58% of North Dakotans would support an even stronger measure to withhold drilling permits for new wells until oil companies put into place the means to capture and take to market the natural gas they're wasting through flaring.
Morrison plans to present the results of this survey to the House Energy and Natural Resources Committee today as it hears that bill. And a House Appropriations Subcommittee will start studying the Public Service Commission's budget proposal. The Senate has already passed its version of the PSC budget.
We came out of the Senate with half of what we had asked for in terms of new programs.
This is Commission Chairman Julie Fedorchak.
They approved the State Rail Supplemental Safety Program, and they removed, out of caution for the still questions that remain in the revenue picture, they removed the Hazardous Materials Pipeline Safety Program.
Fedorchak says she'll be asking the House to reconsider adding back the pipeline safety program. She says both are important.
Two key areas of public concern and interest, two key regulatory areas, long-term for efficiently and appropriately regulating the growing energy industry in the state.
The budget is in the Education and Environment Division of House Appropriations. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You can take Prairie Public's news and entertainment with you wherever you go. Download Prairie Public's free radio app to listen on your iPhone, iPad, or Droid.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. It's no secret that America's roads are in trouble. We've been hearing for a long time that highways, interstates, and bridges are crumbling. And there's an estimated $90 billion annual shortfall in funding to make the repairs. So now would be a good time to raise gas taxes, right? The gas tax is the main funding source for road infrastructure and has been for decades. Wyoming and Iowa have raised theirs in recent years. Other states are considering it. But as Dan Boyce with our Inside Energy team tells us, gas taxes are not a long-term solution.
Casa de Sanchez. It's a colorful little Mexican restaurant in North Denver, basically right in the shadow of a long 6-lane overpass, a bridge called the Interstate 70 Viaduct. Fareed Ali is eating with some coworkers. They repair home exteriors.
Yeah, I do a lot of driving, yep.
They have been relishing recent low gas prices.
I would say we probably cut back, a good $600 to $1,000 a week, maybe?
And they're not terribly keen on handing that money back to the government through a higher gas tax.
I mean, of course not, yeah.
That old conundrum. We don't want to pay higher taxes, but we don't want our bridges to fall down. Bridges like the one right outside the Casa de Sanchez window.
Yeah, I mean, you can notice the old concrete. It's kind of cracking off. There's a lot of areas where it's been rehabilitated.
That's Peter Kaczynski with the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT. He's outside pointing up at the I-70 viaduct, that long overpass. The bottom sort of does look like it's held together with big splotches of putty.
The structure's not going to be able to last forever.
The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates nearly 70,000 bridges across the country are structurally deficient. Kaczynski says tearing down and replacing the I-70 viaduct here in Colorado is at the top of CDOT's priority list. And not only that.
It will be the single most expensive project that we've undertaken, yes.
Over $1 billion for this one project. CDOT says their budget already runs more than $900 million short every year. And higher gas taxes would almost certainly not fill that gap.
As a form of revenue that goes long-term into the future, the gas tax is a dying tax.
That's CDOT Communications Director Amy Ford. Colorado's state gas tax is 22 cents per gallon. It stays the same whether gas is $1.99 or $3.99. And it hasn't been raised since 1993. According to Inside Energy Analysis, if you account for inflation, CDOT is taking in 30% less money from gas taxes now than it did in 2000. And the trend is going ever downward. That's despite a population increase of 1 million people since 2000. More cars and trucks pounding out more miles on Colorado roads. And less money from gas taxes. Increasing the gas tax would help, but the problem is not just inflation. It's a lot bigger than that. Just take a ride in the Toyota Prius CDOT's Amy Ford drives to work.
We've converted this car actually to an electric, so it's not just a hybrid, it's also an electric vehicle.
She barely ever buys gas, so she barely ever pays gas taxes at all.
I am the epitome of the challenge that we have here in the state of Colorado and frankly through the country.
Fuel efficiency is only set to get better, and younger generations are driving fewer miles per person. So transportation planners are reeling, searching for other more sustainable funding options, which may not be any more popular.
Oh, are you serious? They're actually thinking about this?
We're back in the Mexican restaurant with Fareed Ali.
Wow.
That's his response to an idea being studied by 11 Western states and being piloted in Oregon and Colorado this year. Instead of paying a gas tax, the state would track your miles, and you pay based on that.
Wow. Ooh, I don't feel real good about that at all.
Other proposals range from increasing sales taxes to raising the number of toll lanes. And that's actually what's happening with the I-70 viaduct right next to Casa de Sanchez. The state plans to use some temporary money from the state legislature, and they're entering into a partnership with a private company to help pay. Toll lane fees will go back to that company. After hearing about some of these other funding ideas, Fareed Ali changes his mind.
I'll probably go for the gas tax. Yeah, the higher gas tax, yeah. I'd rather just pay at the pump.
Trouble is, that might not be a viable option much longer. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues. Coming up, Chef Rosie talks about quick bread.
On the next Morning Edition, we'll update you on the shooting of two police officers during a protest in Ferguson, Missouri.
We hear three or four shots ring out. Those shots immediately strike two officers that are standing next to each other.
I'm Renee Montaigne. We'll have the latest from Ferguson and a look at community police relations around the country on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. Chef Rosie is in the house to talk about food, of course.
And with St. Patrick's Day right around the corner, we are going to focus in on kind of a specialty here, Irish soda bread. So what is this?
Do we call it Irish soda bread or do we call it American soda bread?
There's
you know,
question.
We tend to only think of it around this time of the year when it's St. Patrick's Day because we've kind of given it back to the Irish, but when in fact you do the research, it's much more of an American soda bread than it is an Irish soda bread.
So where does it come from? I mean, why does Irish get attached to it?
The European settlers brought it to the Americas in the 19th century. It dates back in Serbia to before Christ. So it goes back originally to Serbia, but it was in America before, long before they claimed it in Ireland.
Right.
Okay. So this is a quick bread, I'm assuming?
It is a quick bread, and for those for you understanding the difference between a quick bread and a regular bread, it's very simple. Regular breads are yeast raised, and quick breads are raised by bicarbonate of soda, or as we know it as baking soda, or as in Europe they call it bread soda. But when you take that baking soda and you mix it with an acid, that acid can be yogurt. It can be most commonly an Irish soda bread. It can be buttermilk, it can be soda, it could be lemon juice, it could be anything like that that causes the fermentation which causes it to rise.
Well, anything you would make a volcano out of with the...
That whole leavening part of the bread is what we like the most. We take a soft dough and it rises naturally in the oven, and it's all because of that bicarbonate of soda.
And it's quick bread because you don't have to wait for the yeast to – I mean, how much quicker is it?
It's as quick as mixing it. And speaking about mixing it, it's one of those breads like almost all of the quick breads, whether we're talking about carrot bread or banana bread or beer bread or stout bread, all of these breads that are unleavened breads with yeast, the less you mix it, the more tender it will be. Mm-hmm. Whatever recipe you use, if you put it in your kitchen mixer and walk away from it on high, you will have a tough bread. I don't care what recipe you use. So mix it, the wooden spoon and your arm is the way you mix a quick bread.
What's going on that makes it bad if you overmix it?
Oh, you're talking about food science here. I can't answer that definitively, but you're overworking the gluten in the flour. And when you overwork it, it becomes tough. It's the same thing happens in regular yeast leavened bread, only there's a little bit more time for it to come out of it because it's yeast. It rises to double and triple and four times the size, so it you don't have as much of a toughening problem.
So these are all quick breads, banana bread, biscuits, beer bread, scones, potato bread, but they're different. So what's the difference in terms of preparation between a typical quick bread and a scone, for example?
Well, the one main ingredient is yeast. And the second thing is, when we talk about soda bread, when you bring it to basics, the simplest ingredients would be buttermilk, flour, baking soda, baking powder, and salt. That's it. Hence, that can be a pretty dry, flavorless bread. So then we started adding things to it, typical of the American chef, because we're always trying to make it a little bit better. Well, adding butter, yes, that makes it more tender. Adding cream instead of water, oh, that makes it more rich. Adding some raisins, adding some raisins or some currants, so a little bit of fruit, just like the fruit cake you see at Christmas. That's also a Christmas. It's a quick bread, but adding these extra flavors, orange zest and pecans and pine nuts and maple syrup. We take it to a whole other level. So that's the big difference.
At what point is it no longer a soda bread if you've added all those things to it?
Well, we started with the basics. We started with the soda bread. We just improved on it and added the flavors that we want to complement the meal that we're serving it with.
Well, how does Chef Rosie like to make his soda bread?
Funny you should ask. This morning when I read an article about Irish soda bread, and the article specifically was about gluten-free soda bread, and yes, you can make the same bread with a gluten-free flour and a gluten-free baking powder. And, there's always the people that will say it tastes just as good. I won't say it tastes just as good. I'll say if you're on a gluten-free diet, you can certainly make it very, very palatable. And so I did happen to make some Irish soda bread this morning, and I added maple syrup, Bailey's Irish cream, doubled the butter, heavy cream instead of water. And so we did kick it up a few notches. I wanted to add caraway seeds because caraway seeds is something that I always see in Irish bread. And for me, it's something that I characterize with Irish bread. And I didn't have any, so I skipped those. But that's a flavor that I associate with soda bread on a regular basis.
Whenever I see Irish soda bread, there's always a cross on the top of it. What is going on there?
Well, we can, whether you call that the cross of Christianity or the crucifix, the most important thing, there's a couple of reasons why we put that cross on there. One is we use the term breaking bread. Well, when you cut a cross across a round loaf of bread, it makes it easier to break off segments of the bread. Another reason is that when we bake that bread, the thickest portion is in the very center. So when you cut a cross across the center, it tends to let the bread bake much more evenly, more uniform down the middle. And the third thing is the thing that I really like about it is when you crisscross it, you now give it a much more of a skin area, much more exposed surface area, and that crunchy part is the outside is what we like the best about muffins. It's what we like the best about these kind of breads.
And brown bread, one of my favorite breads, is one of these soda breads.
Yeah, you know, in simple layman's terms, substitute your favorite brown beer. Maybe add brown sugar or molasses instead of granulated sugar. And most importantly, use a dark flour. Whole wheat flour, oat flour, rye flour. That's the big difference. But otherwise, the recipe is completely interchangeable.
Wow. I'm going to have to try it.
Yeah, I think so. And if we do try this for St. Patrick's Day, what other kinds of things should we be eating with the soda bread?
Well, you know, without saying corned beef and cabbage, I guess we'd be remiss. But what I will say is not only corned beef and cabbage, but most of the world, lamb is much more associated with this time of the year. And we're coming into spring, and what we know is spring lamb. Of course, we can buy lamb year-round now, but it was the spring lamb when we harvested the most lamb. But lamb stews, lamb chowders, lamb done different ways is probably one of the most common ways, things to eat with Irish soda bread. But when I think of corned beef and cabbage, I always think of what I was raised on, and that was the corned beef that you buy in the store that's already corned and already pickled and already brined. I'm telling you, this year, try to make your own because
really?
It's pretty difficult. But I will, a word to the wise from a person who just yesterday called 5 different meat markets to buy a fresh brisket of beef, not corned, not pickled, not prepackaged. I wanted a fresh brisket of beef. I found one place, and they would only sell me the whole brisket, which is 15 pounds at about $8 a pound, $120.
That's a pretty expensive corned beef meal. One question I have, soda bread, but when I go to the store, I see soda crackers everywhere. What's the difference?
Well, soda crackers, you'd eliminate the eggs, you'd eliminate the butter from the recipe, and you'd eliminate the cream and use water, and then you would make it a dough that you could roll out thin. And after you roll that dough out thin, one of the things that's common in soda crackers is that you use a baking pricker. It's like a little wheel with little needles on it, and you roll it across the top of the dough to let the steam and the air escape. But it's baking powder, baking soda, water, flour, salt. That's it. And you're rolling it out thin and baking it till it's crisp like a cracker.
Well, bon appetit. That sounds great. If you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
And what's happening is next.
This is Christopher Kimball, host of America's Test Kitchen. Each week I give our test cook Dan a recipe challenge, and it's never easy.
So, Chris, the big challenge with gluten-free baking is that you're not using wheat flour. So what we did is we found 4 basic tricks that led to really excellent chocolate chip cookies.
So join us each week on America's Test Kitchen, a whole new world of food radio.
Sunday at noon Mountain Time, 1 Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, a fair amount is going on, right, Ashley? I think we got some stuff to share with our What's Happening calendar.
You know, spring gets to be a really busy season, and probably just because people are excited to get out and do things. So I think that this one sounds really fun here. An Evening with Rebecca and Kuba, and this is on Friday the 13th, which, by the way, should just kind of be an event unto itself. This is happening in Lisbon at the Lisbon Opera House. Rebecca is a Texas-based singer who has, of course, a penchant, as you might imagine, for singing. She also does a lot of acting, particularly in musical theater, and she's going to be playing with Kuba Kwanik, who is a classically trained jazz musician from Poland. And so they are going to be putting on a variety show with country jazz, show tunes, and classical music. Starts at 7:30 on Friday at the Lisbon Opera House. Tickets are $20.
Well, remember Chef Rosie was talking about soda bread and, you know, we're talking about Irish stuff and this and that. Well, of course, St. Patrick's Day is coming up and the parade is a big one in Fargo. It's going to be Saturday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon down Broadway. Of course, it's free. You just stand there and pick up the candy, I guess. But there's also a Celtic festival that runs from 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon at the Yumcombe Center in Moorhead, and that is also free. So take in St. Patrick's Day on Saturday and enjoy the day.
Add a little to that with the Leprechaun Leap, and that's actually this Sunday, the 15th, in Mandan, or just outside Mandan, really, at the Fort Abraham Lincoln State Park. This is something that they do every year. A little leprechaun decides to visit that park and leave little clues to find his gold all over the park, and it's nice weather to go enjoy a park. So please do that in Mandan at Fort Abraham Lincoln State Park. It gets going at 1 o'clock. Of course, it's free.
And if you're looking for something interesting to do in the Fargo-Moorhead area on Sunday, the public is invited to meet your Muslim neighbor from 2 to 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at the Berry Auditorium in the Grant Center at Concordia College. This event is sponsored by the Forum on Faith and Life at Concordia in partnership with the Center for Interfaith Projects. It is free and open to the public. It's 2 to 4 Sunday afternoon at Berry Auditorium at Concordia College.
The Pisanki Workshop is going to be this Saturday, the 14th, in Dickinson at the Ukrainian Cultural Institute there. If you're not aware of what that is, that's those big, beautiful, decorative eggs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the really
sure.
big ones.
Yeah.
And with just the beautiful hand-done artwork on that. Open to all ages to learn a little about how to do that. It is from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Dickinson, again, at the Ukrainian Cultural Institute this Saturday, and it's $15.
Sunday, the Fargo Theater in downtown Fargo, at 2 o'clock, a tribute to Lawrence Welk. The 112th birthday of Lawrence Welk will be celebrated with a stage filled with musicians. Russell Peterson will lead the Champagne Orchestra. Kathy Brecky will perform a tribute to the Lennon Sisters. And, of course, Meryl Pepcorn hosts the show and plays with the Airheads Acting Group. They'll have some sketches as well. Tickets are $20 and $40. The latter includes a post-show German dinner. It's 2 o'clock Sunday at the Fargo Theater. And for those of you listening right now, you can get a pair of $40 tickets by emailing us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Those $40 tickets mean that you get that post-show German dinner and a very good seat at a very good show.
This is sure to be a good show. Isaac Witte, Friday and Saturday, March 13th and 14th in Bismarck at the Dakota Stage. He is a nationally known comedian. He has been on David Letterman. He's also recently been on Conan, and now he's coming to Bismarck. So go check out this comedian on Friday and Saturday night. So a couple chances to get to see him in Bismarck at Dakota Stage. It starts at 8 o'clock, and ticket prices are $18.
Mini Golf Madness. That's tonight in Grand Forks at the Red Roof Inn, with each of 9 holes decorated by a different local business. It's going to be a unique miniature golfing experience. Participants are encouraged to attend in costumes. There will be prizes for best individual costume, best team theme costume, best team score, best individual score. Golfers will also enjoy a hot buffet and a drink coupon. All proceeds go to restoring the Fire Hall Theater. It's from 6 to 9:30 tonight, and it costs $25, $20 for military and students with ID, or $80 for a team of 4. That's Mini Golf Madness at the Red Roof Inn in Grand Forks tonight.
We still have time to get a team together, Doug. Okay. I think maybe Main Street should come up with some sort of costume. Maybe we could be like a big, long Main Street. That would be really hard to do. But
I'm going to be at Moorhead High School tonight the FM Kicks Jazz Band. They're doing a jazz concert free for the folks to show up, and that starts at 7:15.
All right. I'm going to go with my event of the week, and that's just that, for crying out loud, we have been in the throes of winter for way too long, and it is finally 50s and 60s, and I don't care what you do outside except litter. Do not litter. Just go outside.
I am going to agree totally with you. That would be my pick as well. Matter of fact, I can't get enough of this wonderful early taste of spring. And it is the perfect weather to do a little something outside, like go to a St. Patrick's Day parade, like get out there and enjoy.
Go look for that gold at Fort Abraham Park. Go take in a couple parades. Parades always have candy. You get the opportunity to dress up. It's so, so rare that we have a nice weather weekend for St. Patrick's Day.
And I can tell you, when the weather is good, there will be thousands and thousands and thousands of people in downtown Fargo.
So if you're an extrovert, maybe go check that out.
Okay. Thank you, Ashley Thornburg. Dakota Date Book is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 12th. The 1850s were a time of increasing conflict between the Dakota and settlers who were steadily moving west. The encroachment on traditional hunting grounds left the Dakota frustrated. Relations between the two groups were tense, with sporadic violence. Then came the shocking massacre at Spirit Lake, Iowa. Suffering from cold and hunger, Inkpatuta was angry. He led his band in an attack on the settlers, killing about 30. They crossed into Minnesota, where they killed 7 more. On this date in 1857, they killed 1 more before riding west. News of the killing spurred Minnesota settlers to form militias. They demanded that the marauders be punished, and they attacked any Dakota they could find, even the innocent. The hard feelings remained after the fighting died down. 5 years later came the Dakota Uprising, with both settlers and Dakota suffering casualties. The uprising was short-lived, lasting only 2 months, but led to an ongoing conflict in Dakota Territory. General Henry Hastings Sibley and General Alfred Sully were tasked with following the Dakota and putting an end to the threat they posed. Sibley and Sully led expeditions to do just that in the summer of 1863, but without much success. The summer culminated in Sully's attack on a large gathering at Whitestone Hill. 20 soldiers were killed in the fighting, with Dakota losses estimated at 300, most of them women and children. Sully tried again the following year. He met Inkpaduta at Kildare Mountain. Inkpaduta was joined by noted chiefs Sitting Bull and Gall. Sully seemed to be getting the worst of the fighting until he opened fire with artillery. Once again, women and children were killed. Inkpaduta and his followers decamped and rode for the Badlands. The fighting continued across the Dakotas. In 1876, General Custer rode out of Fort Abraham Lincoln for his last battle at Little Bighorn. The Spirit Lake Massacre happened in Iowa, but over the next several decades, the incident continued to have repercussions in Dakota Territory. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Well, just enough time to tell you what's coming up on Main Street on Friday. We'll meet Russ Petty and Kermit Paulson, two of the missionaries from the Bethel Evangelical Free Church in Devil's Lake. They were detained, suspected of being spies in Venezuela. You probably heard a bit about the story. You'll hear it from them on Main Street tomorrow, the good and the bad. Of course, Pi Day is Saturday, and we're going to talk about it tomorrow with Matt Craig. He is a professor in the physics and astronomy department at Minnesota State Moorhead. And so we'll talk with him. And, of course, Dave Thompson will be here, as he is every Friday, to discuss the news of the week. And Matt Olean will review the animated movie, Chappie. So we hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy spring and have a great evening.